Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm glad to be keeping you company this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a clip from the film Dumb and Dumber.
Hey, want to hear the most annoying sound in the world?
Guys! Guys! Guys!
Fellas, you think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio? Ready, Harry? Mock!
Yeah!
Ing!
Yeah!
Bird!
Yeah!
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 Mockingbird, don't ever...
Now, you might think that's hilarious, or, you know, maybe not. It's hard to put your finger on just what makes something funny. It always seems a little personal and more than a little mysterious. But our guest this hour is developing what may be a unified theory of humor, and that's our topic for the hour. This hour, the science of funny, as we're joined by Peter McGraw. He's an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado, and he's the director of the Humor Research Lab. And we're hoping to hear from you this hour. Do you believe in a formula for funny, or will there always be something about it that we just don't understand? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also chime in, maybe leave a favorite joke on our Facebook page as well. It's the Veronica Rickard Show. Peter McGraw, so good to have you with us today.
It's good to be here.
Why is it so hard to get a handle on what makes things funny?
I think that... inherently, it has to do with the complexity of humor as opposed to other types of kind of emotional experiences. That is, that humor is a really personal thing, that it's something that, as you mentioned earlier, one person might find something hilarious and another find it, you know, boring, not even worthy of their attention, and yet another person is completely offended by it. And that doesn't happen as much with other types of emotional experiences.
You think there's more sort of cohesion among other things, but humor is just more intricate.
Yeah, it is. Well, one is the great diversity, too, in the stimuli that elicit laughter and amusement, ranging, these things range from, puns and wordplay and jokes, to things like slapstick and satire. So the types of things that elicit humor, you know, really runs the gamut. So you combine the differences in people's individual perceptions with the vast array of things that can cause humor or not, and you have a pretty complex subject.
Well, you've been working on this along with a lot of other people who suddenly it seems as though there are a lot of humor studies going on around the country right now, but yours is one that stands out as being a unified theory, something that might explain every kind of humor. That's kind of a holy grail of humor that seems like it's eluded us for a long time. Do you want to talk about benign violation theory?
Sure. So I'm a relative newcomer to this question. Well, in part because the question goes all the way back to Plato and Socrates. So some really great minds have tried to tackle this subject. I've only been studying what makes things funny for about 3 years now. I'm a researcher who generally looks at emotion, judgment, and choice, but had never considered that question, had never even thought about it, had looked at plenty of other emotions, but humor was never on the radar. And I came across the question actually in a talk about what makes things wrong. I was talking about moral judgments in a talk, and I gave an example of a church that was raffling off an H2 Hummer SUV to members of the congregation. they were trying to get him to go to their winter retreat. And they're like, oh, well, just provide an incentive.
It's a pretty big incentive.
And my audience laughed as you did. They sort of chuckled. They were a little bemused by this. And a member of the audience raised her hand and said, hey, you know, you say that moral violations cause anger and disgust, and yet we're laughing. Why? And I was stumped, completely stumped. I had no idea. I had never even thought about it. I didn't know what made things funny. I didn't even have a strong intuition about it. So I started doing the reading, basically, and found just as humor is a sort of complex topic, so is the array of theories that are there. So sorry, I'm having problems here.
No,
so we had okay, sorry. So we ended up basically trying to look at these different theories and seeing how they made sense. And what was really an interesting thing is that some theories made sense for some types of humor, but not theories for other types of humor. And I'm a guy who likes parsimony. Like, I like simple explanations, and there are fairly simple explanations for the emotions that we have otherwise. And we set about trying to answer this and came across a theory that Tom Veitch, who's a linguist and happens to not be in academia anymore, but he wrote a paper that I found to be really very useful in this. And from that arose this idea that humor is elicited by benign violations. That is, that it has its roots in kind of negative experiences, things that sort of threaten us, that make us unsettled, scare us, make us angry, make us disgusted, perplex us, that at the same time we're able to perceive as benign or okay or acceptable in some way. And this tends to, I think, across the many forms of humor eliciting stimuli, cause us to be amused.
Can you give us an example? A simple one?
A simple example. So this is an example that is actually really controversial, but I think that works intuitively. And that is tickling. So typically, humor theorists set tickling aside as play, and that's not humor. That's a different phenomenon. But tickling is like a lot of other forms of sort of physical humor. It's a mock attack. It's an attack that's not meant to hurt, right? So you experience the threat of a loved one tickling you. There is an unpleasantness to it all. But, you know, as long as the attack doesn't go too far or is not too aggressive, it's okay, it's safe, right? And so that sort of fits these conditions of a violation and a benign appraisal there. And what's interesting about it is it also, when you think about how tickling fails, it also doesn't meet those standards. So for instance, if you tried to tickle yourself right now, you wouldn't laugh. There's nothing threatening about that situation, right? Because you're doing it yourself.
So when you talk about threatening situations and when they are and aren't, that sounds like you're getting at something older. Maybe that humor evolved to keep us safe and to realize when it was time to go into fight or flight and when it was time, you know, to laugh.
Yes, indeed. I actually I find that to be a really sort of compelling piece of the puzzle. So any question about emotions and how and why we have them, there at least you should be able to make a compelling evolutionary story, even if you're not able to actually test it. And in the case of humor and a benign violation account of it, it seems to fit. So if you think about our predecessors, and by the way, even today, non-human primates like apes, chimps, bonobos, and so on, laugh. It's sort of a panting sound, but it's very similar to the actual vocalizations of laughter that humans have. And these non-human primates, they laugh when they're tickled, and they laugh when they're play fighting. So from an evolutionary sense, you can imagine a world that is that has its threats out there, and you need to be cognizant and aware of those particular threats. And when those threats are there, you need to run away or you need to fight. And the ability to recognize that a potential threat is actually benign is not the threat that you thought it was. You could imagine how that would elicit positive emotions, right? This negatively arousing thing all of a sudden becomes positively arousing. And the laughter, the vocalization, is a signal to your kin that the coast is actually clear. Right? That may help explain why laughter is contagious, so it spreads through a group. And that our predecessors, who were quite good at recognizing benign threats, you know, they didn't run away when there was something that was good to approach. And the ones who were bad, who thought threats were benign but they weren't, they got eaten by the woolly mammoth, right? And they did not, you know, continue on. I think it fits. And I think that the sort of developmental biologists, evolutionary biologists, and so on might concur.
Well, you use another example when you talk about your benign violations, and you're a fan of Sarah Silverman, and we have a clip of hers. Let's listen to it, and then we'll talk about it. This is Sarah Silverman.
Thank you so much for being here. So much love here. And I got to say, you look fantastic. You look beautiful.
Thank you. You know what? I like to tell people that it's not bad for just having had a baby, huh? And I like to tell people that because then they're always like, you look amazing.
Yeah. But you don't have kids. Does that ever come up?
I guess I don't. Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, let me just say it was really hard to find a Sarah Silverman clip that we could play on the air. And that was about as mellow as she gets. But you think she's a good example of why your theory works. Why?
Well, so I do. I think the reason is that many of the things, most of the things, as you, you know, as demonstrated by the problem of finding something fitting for public radio, many of the things that Sarah says could be classified as a hate crime in many parts of the world. I mean, she really pushes the envelope and takes on the most taboo topics. And yet, other people, myself, you know, included, tried to repeat those things, we would lose our jobs. And yet she manages to elicit laughter. So the violation of the things that Sarah says, lying about having been pregnant, are clear, right? It's almost no debating the fact that these are sort of wrong things to be saying. What makes it benign? Well, one is it helps to know that Sarah is a comedian to begin with. So there is this presumption that she's actually not being honest, right? That she's playing, that she's joking, and so on. The other is that Sarah is just not a threatening figure, right? She's cute, and she has this sort of cute, almost girly kind of voice and almost an innocence in which she sort of presents these things, but you could almost argue sort of childlike. And, you know, we give children a lot of leeway with regard to the things that they say are wrong, and we often find it cute and funny that they do it because they don't really understand it all. And so in that way, I think that Sarah's able to transform these violations into benign violations with her delivery, with a sort of non-threatening delivery.
Okay, well, that works well for Sarah Silverman. What about some absurdist humor, something like Monty Python? I mean, my husband has been going around lately singing the Eric the Half a Bee song, and I don't see the violation there. What about that kind of humor?
Yeah, so, okay, where we're heading right now is to a difficult place. And the reason I say this is that because of humor's complexity, it's hard for me to deconstruct any one example, in part because I'm not familiar enough with that song. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe you're not either, in the sense of, you know, you don't recognize the potential violations. So I find myself hesitant to do this. And the reason is not because it isn't fun. It's a lot of fun. Is that's what humor theorists have been doing for thousands of years, right? That's what Plato and Socrates did. That's what Kant and Hobbes have done, and Freud, and so on. And I really believe that to try to get at the heart of this stuff, we need to spend some time in the laboratory actually collecting data on these things, which is why I started the Humor Research Lab, or as we call it HURL.
Can you tell us a little bit about what exactly you're studying there? What are the experiments you're working on?
So this is work that I collaborate with Caleb Warren on. So Caleb was a graduate student at the University of Colorado. He's now an assistant professor at Bocconi, but he's still involved in the lab. So we're trying to answer this question as you would answer most other sort of psychological questions, using surveys, using experiments, and so on. One of the projects that we're working on that I'm pretty excited about tests a very sort of fundamental idea within comedy and actually within humor research, and that is that psychological distance helps transform tragedy into comedy. So Mark Twain was famously quoted as saying that, you know, humor is tragedy plus time. And there's another quote by Mel Brooks that I like quite a lot that says, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall down an open sewer and die. And so it really, from a benign violation account, it puts it right there. So how do you take a violation and make it benign? Well, you create some distance from it. Right. So maybe time passes. You can't laugh about falling down the stairs right now. It's too close. But later, a week later, a month later, years later, you can chuckle about it. It may be social. So, I can't laugh when something happens to me or someone close to me. But when it happens to a stranger, or certainly if it happens to my enemy, you know, I'll laugh. So Hobbes talked about superiority theory, that we laugh at our sudden glory over our enemies. Psychological distance can have this distance element. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier for people in the U.S. to make jokes about natural disasters in other countries than they are able to make jokes about natural disasters in their own country. And then finally, this idea of what we call hypotheticality. As I alluded to earlier with Sarah Silverman, she's making this stuff up, right? Because she's designing jokes as a comedian. But when something is real, sometimes it's too close to laugh at. But when it's in cartoon form, like South Park or The Family Guy, these very same violations can then thus sort of become amusing. So we've been testing that relationship. And it's a pretty robust relationship and consistent with both intuition and with some prior work. What's really interesting is that if you subscribe to a benign violation account, you can make a different prediction for milder violations, for mishaps, for very mild things that are bad. If it's the case that, for instance, it's easier to laugh at having gotten hit by a car 5 years ago than it is if you got hit by the car yesterday, right? Because there's still some threat of that event, but it's far enough away that it's benign. What about something very simple like stumbling on a curb? Right? This is still threatening. There's still something bad or wrong about it, but it's very, very mild. Stumbling on a curb 5 years ago, there's nothing wrong about that now. It's just so far away that it's not even worthy of our attention.
Mm-hmm.
But stumbling on a curb today or yesterday, that might be, by virtue of pushing it closer to you, still able to maintain the violation there. And what we've been showing is that the degree to which something is really bad or just slightly bad interacts with how far away it is. So there's sort of this sweet spot of humor that you can't be too far away if it's mild, and it can't be too close if it's severe.
Mm, I see. The distance matters in how funny it is.
Exactly, right? So you think about the joke. So, you know, remember Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter?
Yeah.
So there's a pretty good South Park episode that within like a week or so of him dying, they had an image of him, a character of him with the stingray barb sticking out of his chest.
Ooh.
And they made the joke too soon, right? And so there was an evolution of Steve Irwin jokes that happened after his death, that in which they were sort of, it was too soon to say, to tell him the next day. But with some distance, it was sort of okay. But no one tells Steve Irwin jokes anymore because so much time has passed that there really is no sort of threat anymore.
Well, I'm going to jump in there so we can take our first break and also so we can get some more callers in on the topic as we talk about the science of humor with our guest, Peter McGraw. He's an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado and the director of the Humor Research Lab there. And we're hoping to hear from you this hour. Do you think there is a unified theory of funny? What do you think about the benign violation theory that we're hearing about this morning? Does it cut the mustard for you? And do you want to know how humor works? Or is it better to have a little bit of mystery? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do the people that work in these little shops in the airport have any idea what the prices are every place else in the world? Yeah, $14 tuna sandwich. We think that's fair. That's what we charge in our country. Then you get on the plane. Pilot, of course, always has to come on the PA system. This guy's so excited about being a pilot, he can't even stand himself. Well, I'm going to take it up to about $20,000. And I'm going to make a left by Pittsburgh. Then I'm going to make a right by Chicago. Then I'm going to bring it down to 15,000. It's giving you the whole route, all his moves. We're in the back going, yeah, fine, that's all. You know, just do whatever the hell you got to do. I don't know.
Of course, a bit of the routine from Jerry Seinfeld there. As we talk about the science of funny, trying to crack the nut on how to unpack a joke like that, a routine like that, and whether there can be a unified theory of funny. And our guest is Peter McGraw. He's an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado and director of the Humor Research Lab there as well. And we'll take our first caller. We have David joining us from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings. Hey, I wanted to ask you about propaganda and the use of humor. It seems to me that the current forms of propaganda are using a big sneer and that they're using disparaging humor to laugh at those that are not equal to the so-called the party in power, let's say, and so they're sneering at their opposition, and they're creating a kind of a master race humor, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that, and just that kind of nihilism when you look at something like global warming and how profound it is, and the scientists are sneered at as if they're eggheads and whatnot, and so that. You know, their science is not taken even, there's no discussion because of this ill-placed humor.
Kind of using humor to discredit people and humiliate them is
right.
What you're talking about. Okay, well, thank you, David. And by the way, it's very cool that you're listening in San Francisco, California. Peter McGraw, what do you think?
That is an interesting question. There actually is a long history of humor as a weapon of subversion. So, for instance, one of the earliest, actually the earliest documented Greek comedy is a comedic farce called Lysistrata. And it was designed to, in many ways, criticize the government and to try to compel the government to end the Peloponnesian War. And in the comedy, the women all collude to withhold sex from their husbands and lovers until this war ends. And this issue of using humor to criticize political leaders, has continued on. I know that the Nazis actually, banned the use of humor against the Führer because they recognized the power that can have to sort of discredit, as was said, people in power. What I think is interesting is that it also is a way oftentimes to criticize that's less risky than a more aggressive form of criticism. That is that, governments are actually more likely to be tolerant of amusing criticisms of their leadership, of their of the government. It also is more attention-getting. So there's also a lot of research that shows how humor is more attention-getting. It's more memorable. You're more likely to sort of like and pay attention to the person who's using humor versus not. And so in that way, humor can be really an effective way to get your message out and to get it out in a way that is not as sort of scornful as just complaining about it. And so, and then lastly, there's also a huge literature on how humor is used to cope with, stress, pain, adversity, for the negative things in our life. And so to use humor to criticize in some ways may benefit the criticizer in that he or she is sort of better able to sort of deal with things that are negative so that they can make fun of it. Maybe it's also then a way to make it more okay in their eyes. So there's
humor has
touch points with regard to the use of humor to degrade our political leaders, to degrade the people that we disagree with, to sort of try to strip them of some of their power.
And humor has such cultural cachet. If you can be funny, you're already a couple steps ahead of the other guy, and you can understand why marketers, in particular, would be interested in this, because funny commercials sell products. For instance, I'm thinking about the Groupon ads that aired during the Super Bowl that were trying so hard to be funny, but it ended up being mostly offensive. If marketers could figure out the formula for that, I mean, that's another implication for good or bad, for good or evil.
For good or evil, yes. I think the Groupon ad was a really nice example of this, the need to find this sweet spot, right? That you dance on the edge. That if you need a violation to create humor, well, when you fail, you can fail on the side of offending your potential customers, alienating them. What's interesting, though, is that humor also is a powerful thing for the consumer, and this is what I'm more interested in. So if you're familiar with David Carroll's parody music video called United Breaks Guitars, it's a YouTube video that has 10 million hits, in which he creates a very funny song about his experience with United Airlines and then breaking his guitar. Well, this went viral immediately and coincided with about a 10% drop in United stock.
Wow.
Incredible effect with regard to complaining about a brand that was unresponsive, but doing it in a humorous way that helped gather attention and made it memorable and really sticky in the marketplace. So this same weapon of subversion that has been used against governments seems to be being used against brands at times now.
Well, thank you so much for your call, David. I appreciate that. And we'll move on to Jenny in Delafield. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. My question is a little bit related to the previous caller's question, and that is how aggression is sometimes disguised as humor, or how humor is used to express aggression, and especially as it relates to conversations or interactions between men and women, because I find that oftentimes I'll express maybe a political viewpoint or make a point to a male audience or a male in particular, and their response is rather than addressing the issue, they'll make some kind of sexist joke or some kind of joke that they think is funny that's a little bit derogatory towards women. And so I was wondering if he could address how I think humor is sometimes used to express aggression, and especially as it relates to the different genders.
All right. Thank you, Jenny. And Peter?
Yeah, so that that does, I think, relate to David's question, and especially because there is this sort of dark side to humor. It hasn't always been the case that the world has thought of humor as this sort of good thing. You know, Plato worried about the use of humor against governments, and there have been times in history in Europe and so on where people have written against humor because, for the very reasons that you talked about there, is that because it can be associated with disparagement, bad things happening to other people, sort of reveling in other people's follies and faults and bad luck, there's this idea of laughing with versus laughing at. And I think that the distinction in U.S. culture comes about when people make this distinction between teasing and bullying. And there is a line between teasing and bullying, and what happens, what I think Jenny's describing, is that someone's bullying, but they're trying to disguise it as teasing. And the main difference between bullying and teasing is that teasing is actually designed to enhance social relationships. It's actually designed to bring people closer together, to address uncomfortable topics in a way that's sort of smoother and easier through the use of humor. And so it may at first blush look like it's not being, you know, it's not nice, but the two people feel closer together as a result of it. Mm. But bullying doesn't do that. Bullying is designed to create a disparity between the two and to assert, you know, sort of superiority, to push other people down. And I think what Jenny's describing is a veiled way to try to bully in many ways, and to use humor as a way, maybe perhaps, that it doesn't seem as obvious, but that's clearly what's happening.
Well, thank you, Jenny. I appreciate your call. And we move to Bob in Waukesha. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Frank Zappa was a very funny man, and with his humor also made very incisive points of view. With his lyrics, he made fun of everything and Buddy. And he was at the cutting edge early on, pointing fingers at things that were happening before most people knew they were even happening. I laugh at jokes first and foremost for the cleverness of the humor, which doesn't mean that I agree with the sentiment of the humor, but I laugh at the cleverness of it. In the 1970s, I was working at Madison General Hospital physical therapy department. This young man, who was wheelchair bound for life, rolled in with a sticker on the back of his wheelchair that proclaimed, "Hire the handicap. They're fun to laugh at." As John Prine sings, it's a big old goofy world.
Hmm.
And just remember, it takes a big man to cry, and it takes an even bigger man to laugh at that man crying. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that call. A lot to go on there, but I want to talk a little bit about the cleverness of humor. I mean, a lot of us do like a little bit of cleverness in our humor, but look at that Dumb and Dumber clip. Things don't have to be clever to be funny all the time. I guess that's where the matter of taste comes in.
It is. So the cleverness idea, I think, is one that I frankly haven't thought deeply enough about, because I think that there is this sort of important idea of the getting it, the joy of getting it when it comes to a joke, that there's something really fundamentally appealing about being connecting, like, oh, I get it, you know, versus that feeling you have when someone tells a joke and you don't get it. You feel like, what's wrong with me? Why don't I understand this? But, I think that the cleverness thing, if you can think about humor, the things that are funny, as a sort of pyramid, where the things at the bottom everybody gets, and the things at the top only a very, very few number of people get. And how do you explain that, right? How do you explain the vast individual differences? Well, so things like physical humor, whether it be play, tickling and play fighting, or things like slapstick, you know, like the very popular Super Bowl ads that, you know, show Betty White getting tackled, right, trying to play football, those tend to be amusing to a wide swath of the population. They tend to be amusing even cross cultures. And the reason is, I think, that physical threats are the sort of most fundamental humor-eliciting stimuli from an evolutionary standpoint. But if you start to go and get to be sort of more cognitive, more intellectual, well, now there needs to be a knowledge structure in place for you to both understand the violation, what is it that's wrong about the situation, and then also how it might be okay. And that is highly culturally specific, as you might imagine, right? The norms and rules that you follow in day-to-day life are different in different places. And then the ability to interpret those things. And so the previous caller, I think, makes that point really nicely. Like, Zappa is clever, and his writings were often, you know, pretty advanced in that way. And so some people listened to his music and just enjoyed it musically, and others could read more deeply into it and thus enjoy the sort of cleverness of his amusement.
Well, thank you for that call. And we take our second break right now as we talk the science of humor with Peter McGraw. He's an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado, and he's the director of the Humor Research Lab there. And hopefully we'll be talking to more of you as we go along this hour. We want to know what you think about a formula for funny. What do you think is funny? Do you have a theory of your own? Or what do you think about the benign violation theory, that these small transgressions into morality make things funny when we realize that they're harmless? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I got a call from a telemarketer, and he said, hello, Mr. Harmston. Are you paying too much for your auto insurance? And I said, yeah, I am, because I drove into a marching band on the way home from a wine tasting. What can you do for me? And then he was like, oh, I think I dialed the wrong number.
A comedian named Tim Harmston from Minneapolis, as we talk about the science of humor this hour with Peter McGraw, an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado, and he is the director of the Humor Research Lab there. Peter, what do you think about that joke? Is it okay to joke about that?
I think it is. That was pretty funny. I hadn't heard that one. I mean, it certainly seemed to be to the audience, right? I think that's, they're sort of the ultimate decider when it comes to comedy on the stage.
And that definitely illustrates your theory there. I mean, you're joking about something that's not that funny, with a little, if you take it seriously, but taken, you know, with a little twist, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think the idea is that it's pretty easy for everybody in that audience to identify with getting a telemarketer and wanting a reason to get off the phone with them. And ideally to have the telemarketer want to end the call. And so to make up a story as outrageous as that to sort of, you know, take away the motivation of the telemarketer. It does demonstrate that sort of cleverness that's there. And you could see why the kind of making a comment about running over, drunk driving and running over marching band might be okay, given the motivation of trying to escape this telemarketer, you know, could fit this set of conditions that I've put forth.
Let's read a couple of emails now. We have one from Robin in Mineral Point who says, I had no idea that humor had become an academic subject. How many humor labs are there? Are people studying it all over the world?
It's a fairly small... So I'm an outsider in the world of humor research. So there is a society of humor researchers, the International Society for Humor Studies. I'm actually headed to Boston in July to present a paper to these folks, most of whom I've never met before. It is international. So there are folks in all over the world, and they actually host the conference internationally every other year. There's not a lot of labs dedicated to it, which I was happy that Humor Research Lab, aka HURL, was actually available at the time for that reason. It's sort of a small interdisciplinary group of scholars ranging from psychologists like myself to historians, folks who study English, linguistics, evolutionary biology, mathematics, computer science. So it's a really diverse group of people approaching this difficult question in many different ways.
Well, getting a little deeper into the topic about how okay it is to be subversive and to talk about taboo things. Excuse me, an email here from Tom who says, it's interesting what your guest said about Sarah Silverman getting away with things because she's cute and seems unthreatening. I think some comedians think they can use humor to get away with things and then quickly learn they've gone too far. I'm thinking of Michael Richards from Seinfeld and the Tracy Morgan controversy happening now.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yes, I think that... that you're dancing on the edge, the use of sort of taboo topics is a good way to create these violations. And my guess is that comedians, they really end up taking risks when they start speaking extemporaneously. So if you step back and you think about what comedians do very, very well, it's that they write material and they test it and they hone their performance of it. And so comedians in many ways are more like stage actors, performers in a theater, than they are your buddy who's really funny at a party. And so good comedians write many, many jokes, find the ones that they think are funny, test them over time, and then perform them in a way that helps maximize their funniness. But when you have, Tracy Morgan or Richards, who's sort of speaking off the cuff, who go on a rant, who move away from their set material, now things get really risky because they haven't sort of tested these things out. They haven't vetted them, and they can go too far.
And maybe that's a distinction the comedians themselves need to think a little bit more about. They're just not funny in a generic kind of way. They need to be a little more crafted in what they say.
Yeah, I think that they are probably funnier than average, certainly, funnier than you and me generally. But still, it's so difficult to get up on stage, right, and have a group of people who are looking at you with the perception, make me laugh, and not be prepared for it. And so the more they move away from their prepared stuff, I think the riskier it gets.
Let's take another phone call now. We've got Paul joining us from Racine. Hey, Paul.
Hi. I really thought this was going to be one of the nerdiest NPR shows I could have imagined. But
Thanks for your honesty.
Upon further review, it's very interesting. And I called it to talk about the Tracy Morgan thing, and somebody stole my thunder with an email. But I'm fascinated by this, and I think it gets into the fact that media is present now anywhere. And so somebody, I think, blogged about Tracy Morgan's joke and got him in trouble, and in much the same way Michael Richards got caught on cell phone camera and... To me, I love humor, and all the clips you're playing are funny, and it seems like we're awash in comedians. The shows that we have on TV now, stand-up is, I think, better than it maybe has ever been in history. There's just so many stand-up comedians. And it seems like stand-up, maybe you're proving that Michael Richards and Tracy Morgan don't necessarily translate as well on the stage, at least personally. I like them both in what they've done, and I like Tracy Morgan especially. I'm a big fan of his on 30 Rock. I never really cared for him all that much on Saturday Night Live, but I think that the absurdity of his persona on 30 Rock is what makes him funny. And clearly he bombed with the jokes that he made, but I think what's even more absurd now is society's forcing him to apologize and seems to think that now he's going to embrace the LGBT community and that he, you know, and so I'm kind of uncomfortable with this notion of forcing. We love comedians when they make us laugh, but when they go too far, test out material, and it's almost, for me, it seems like Tracy Morgan's having kind of a cathartic experience. Maybe he's uncomfortable with the idea of having a gay son or daughter, and that means, I may not agree with that, but I get why he would want to work through that on stage. And
so, Paul, just to jump in, so you think that comedians should be given a little bit longer leash than other people?
Yeah, I do. I mean, if we're going to expect them to make us laugh, we should also accept that sometimes they're going to cross a line that, you know, I may not agree, and I think another caller had said that, I may not agree with Tracy Morgan's joke, and clearly the audience is going to let him know. Now, maybe down in Tennessee, they're going to think, woo-hoo, and then we have more to worry about the audience. But that's what they do. They push limits. They cross lines in order to make us laugh. They, like the guest said, mm-hmm. Very astutely, they're honing their craft, and they do it on stage. And sometimes they're going to say things that are going to make us nauseous. I mean, and that joke may make a lot of people uncomfortable, but it doesn't change the fact that he was thinking it. And I think a lot of comedians work through issues, not to get too academic and nerdy about it, but, you know, they're working through things that make them uncomfortable. And I bet a lot of people are uncomfortable. It doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it wrong. They're just uncomfortable with that notion. And Tracy Morgan said it. And the jokes that he also said couched around that joke about having a gay son or daughter was the issue of bullying and this kind of cause celeb nature of these, you know, everybody saying stop bullying. Well, it comes across as kind of disingenuous. And I think that's why we like comedians.
I want to get our guest in on this. Peter, what do you think about using humor as catharsis and that sometimes we're going to get some appalling things coming out of that process, but maybe that's okay?
Yeah, so Freud was an advocate of what's generally called release or relief theories. And his take on humor was that it was a way for kind of taboo topics, sexual and aggressive tendencies that we carry around within us, to sort of escape in an okay or acceptable way. And so there is this sort of belief that humor can help with these sort of cathartic, desires that we have. And it certainly seems to be playing a little bit of a role here, as Paul has mentioned. And what I think is sort of good that comes out of this Tracy Morgan situation is that it has brought this topic, right? This is a sensitive topic. It's a timely issue. It's one that's often really divisive. And so that it's bringing it into the public discourse in a way that I think is actually helpful, because it does help kind of talk about explicitly what are the boundaries with regard to gay and lesbian folks in our society in terms of how they should be treated and how they should be discussed and what is their role and so on. And so, you know, humor should be part of the public discourse. And yes, the risk is going to be you've gone too far when it comes to joking or when it comes to addressing these things. I would like to say one other thing that Paul brought up, and I think it's a great point. He used this term that we're sort of awash in comedy, right? In the connection mm-hmm. that we have. And I think that that's a great advantage for us nerds who are interested in studying humor. So where the social sciences have brought us with things like neuroscience and experimental work, things that we're doing in the Humor Research Lab, right, really cutting-edge stuff we can apply to these topics. But also, because of the internet, this is sort of a golden age of comedy, where when you were younger, if you wanted to hear Lenny Bruce, you might not be able to find his album in your local record stores because it was banned. Now, you just a few keystrokes, you can reach any humorist in the world and see what he or she is saying, whether it be politically, whether it be stand-up, whether it be improvisational, whether it be just fun linguistic type of stuff.
And we're out of time, but Peter McGraw, I want to thank you so much for being on today. It's been a lot of fun.
This is great. Thank you.
Peter McGraw, our guest, an assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado, where he directs the Humor Research Lab. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.